This is an interview with Peter Knights of the Global Survival Foundation and the Barbara Delano Foundation. It was recorded for the program Unheard Cries on 93.7 San Francisco Liberation Radio. I'm Jackie Dove. We're speaking with Peter Knights of the Barbara Delano Foundation. He's the program director there and formerly of the Global Survival Network. Thanks very much for coming on the program.
No problem.
Let's start off with some information about the Global Survival Network. Can you tell us what it is and when it was formed?
Well, the Global Survival Network was formed in 1995, and it's a very small organization that works internationally on a number of wildlife issues and also human rights issues. And what those have in common, really, is our method of working. What we like to try and do is get inside a problem using undercover agents, be it the illegal trade in rhino horn or tiger bone, or the trafficking in women for prostitution, which the mafia in Russia has been involved with latterly.
And what exactly is the role that you play in, say, animal rights, environmentalism, and human rights activities?
Well, it's really more conservation than animal rights, but what we try and do is, as I say, look into a problem, get involved in the business, the industry, if you like, particularly the illegal aspects of the industry, find out the abuses that are going on, document that with film, and then we produce heavily researched reports, which are media friendly, if you like, accompanied with photographs and video, and then try and use that to get changes in laws, government, more active enforcement, all sorts of different issues in national and international fora.
What is the connection between the Barbara Delano Foundation and the Global Survival Network?
Well, the Barbara Delano Foundation part funds the Global Survival Network on their Siberian Tiger program, which is anti-poaching for the Siberian tiger. Also on the Asian Conservation Awareness Program, which is a program to try and raise awareness of conservation threats in Asian communities around the world, and several other projects that we've funded as well. So the Barbara Delano Foundation is a San Francisco-based foundation that is dedicated to protecting wildlife around the world.
And how did you get involved with the Global Survival Network? What is your background?
I was working for 5 years with an organization called the Environmental Investigation Agency based in London, and we did a lot of these undercover research into trade in birds for the pet trade, wild birds for the pet trade, illegal ivory trade, and many other wildlife issues. And some of us decided at some point we wanted to break away slightly and not just do the investigations, but also work more on the longer-term solutions, whether it was, in my colleague Steve Gulster's case, working on protecting the Siberian tiger by raising funds for poaching, anti-poaching teams out in Russia, in my case to do the sort of education and awareness of the Asian Conservation Awareness Program. So to sort of follow on from the work, it was a natural progression from the work we were doing with the investigations.
Well, I'd like to go into a little more detail about the investigations. I'd like to hear a little bit more about your experiences on the anti-poaching detail. I think a lot of people would be really interested in what an investigator actually does.
Well, it varies. We usually don't get involved so much with the actual anti-poaching aspects as the sort of trade end of it, if you like. In terms of doing an investigation, what we'll often do is pose as prospective buyers of some of these products. We don't actually ever buy any of these products, but we will pose as buyers and set up quite elaborate covers sometimes for ourselves to find out what is actually going on. Obviously, many of these things, it's illegal to sell, but then quite often, very superficially under the surface, you can find people are quite happy to sell these things, and they'll often divulge their methods of smuggling and you know, cheating with paperwork, forging paperwork to get these products around the world. So what we'll do is we'll set ourselves up as businessmen interested in purchasing, whether it be tiger bone or bear gall bladder or whatever, and we have a variety of agents and covers that we'll use to get inside the business, and then we'll use undercover, very small hidden cameras to film what's going on, to then take that as evidence before international forum like the Convention on International Trade and Endangered Species to try and get people to do something about it. So we're not usually trying to catch individuals as perhaps a police force or customs or maybe the Fish and Wildlife Service might be. What we're trying to do is illustrate a problem and then get action to remedial action for those problems. So it's really to illustrate something that's going on rather than to catch individuals.
Right. And do you have a lot of notable successes when you demonstrate what the problems are in front of these international forums?
Most environmental work is sort of, you know, two steps forward, one step backwards, and quite often you have to defend whatever victories you do get. But to give you an example, when we were working on the wild bird trade, this is back when the Environmental Investigation Agency, we managed to persuade 150 airlines to stop carrying wild birds for the pet trade. And that almost decreased the trade to nothing. And we also managed to get a bill through Congress, working with a coalition of about 300 different conservation organizations, which effectively stopped the import of wild parrots to the United States. And it was actually quite funny. I was hearing the other day that some of the pet traders were totally opposed to this bill and said it would ruin them and it'd be the end of the world for them. And in fact, now some of those same people are now saying, oh, we think that this Wild Bird Conservation Act is marvelous. And of course, breeding of birds has increased quite strongly as a result of this. And now the people, the customers are happy because they get captive bred, healthier birds. We're not having the negative effects on the populations in the wild. And basically, it's all worked out fine. But at the time, it was a tooth and nail struggle to get that bill through. So that's one example. We've also, I think, had a lot of success in Asia with getting laws tightened up. Enforcement is greatly improved. And the education and awareness aspects of trades like the rhino horn trade and the tiger bone trade, bear gall bladder, I think all those businesses have been greatly reduced as a result of the work of not just ourselves, but a number of conservation groups.
I'm going to go into some detail about those later on. We have massive violations of human rights and depredation of the environment all over the planet, and often in defiance of international law. Who would you say are the major culprits? Would you say it's worldwide corruption, organized crime, apathetic governments, apathetic populations, commercialism, consumerism? Where would you pin the blame?
Well, just about all of those you've mentioned, I think, come into blame, depending on what the problem and where it is. Something I'm working on just at the moment is quite interesting, is the mass deaths of turtles off the Orissa coast in India. And there you see these things, and superficially it looks quite simple. Basically, it's trawling for the shrimp industry that's causing a lot of the problems. And then you get underneath the surface, and there's all sorts of other institutional problems which are causing this whole thing. So it's really a combination of a number of those factors that you've mentioned. I think one of the biggest problems we suffer from at the moment is that international bodies, such as the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species, or CITES, which covers a lot of the animals that I'm talking about, doesn't actually have any teeth. It relies on the individual governments and their implementation of the convention. And what we really don't have is any sort of international police force. I know some people are totally paranoid about this idea, but when you're talking about things like policing the international oceans, who does it? I mean, the sea doesn't fall under any individual government. And so it's a free-for-all out there, and as a consequence, people are just strip mining the seas. The fish populations are being decimated all over the world. And so that is a real problem, which I think we've got to, coming into the next century, we do have to address, is, you know, we are getting some quite good laws put in now, but we have to make sure they're enforced. And if we don't, then there'll be nothing left for anybody. I mean, it's a huge struggle to get these laws agreed by people. And then when you do that, it's another vast struggle to try and get those laws enforced.
Well, it's interesting you're talking about enforcement, because it seems like the big corporations are out there deforesting the earth and dredging up the oceans and destroying habitat all over the place. How do you handle the amorphous and massive enormity of multinational corporations who seem to be accountable to no one and are more powerful than governments?
Well, in fact, some of the multinationals, I think, are perhaps easier to tackle than some of the other people that are out there. To give you an example, another thing which the foundation is just going to provide some funding for, Mitsubishi, the giant Japanese conglomerate that it has car businesses, obviously, and electrical goods, but also one of the things it's involved in is solar salt mining. And in fact, the gray whales that come past San Francisco every year, They actually breed in Baja, Mexico, and there's four lagoons where they breed, and one of those lagoons, the only, well, the real pristine one that's left there, Mitsubishi wants to build a solar salt plant there, which would involve building a 2.5-kilometer jetty out in this beautiful pristine area where you can actually go there and actually touch the whales. It's an incredible place. And they want to build a salt plant there. So, I mean, something like that, there is room for maneuver. I think there's room for international campaigns to boycott Mitsubishi's goods, their whether it's their cars or their televisions and things like that. And then perhaps we can make them listen. So in some cases, in fact, the multinationals, where you can tie them in with a face and somewhere where the public can react, that's a lot easier to deal with than some of these things which go on which don't have a corporate face, if you like.
It seems like governments all over the world, and I would include the U.S. government there too, seem to have very little interest in habitat conservation and wildlife protection. Why is that?
Well, I do have to say I've done a lot of work with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and I've found them in the fields that I've been working in certainly to be excellent, actual fact, and very progressive and very keen to do the right thing. One indication of this was Secretary Bruce Babbitt, in fact, put sanctions on Taiwan for rhino and tiger trade several years ago, and that was an unprecedented move, and it was really put under quite a lot of criticism. But I can tell you this from my experience, the people I know in Taiwan, they now say that that has really greatly affected the rhino and tiger trade, and there's virtually none of that going on anymore. So my personal experience with the Fish and Wildlife Service has been very positive. However, the habitat issue is a massive issue, and obviously there's all sorts of vested interests involved there. And I think one of the problems is that some of our agencies, not just here in the US but everywhere in the world, come for the Forest Service, for example, they come from the resource utilization background rather than a conservation background. And so historically their tradition is to see resources as just something to be exploited, nature to be exploited, as opposed to being something which nowadays, I mean, I think most of the public would agree that we have so few sort of pristine areas that we really should be keeping them for their value of being pristine. So I think that's one of the problems. But the vested interests, particularly in the US, I'm afraid, are very, very powerful, whether it's the oil industry or the ranching lobby, whether it's the NRA. I mean, there are huge vested interests there which are extremely powerful, and it is a real struggle to fight against interests like that.
Yeah, I think that's what I was referring to, in fact. One report estimated that the global trafficking in wildlife worldwide is worth about $6 billion a year, second only to the drug trade. I find that really astounding. Can you give some comment about that?
Well, it's obviously a guesstimate, because we're talking about the illegal trade in wildlife, and quite a large component of that would be the illegal timber trade, which is absolutely massive. Illegal logging, whether it's in the Russian Far East, Siberia, which is one of the largest intact areas, which has just been totally destroyed, often illegally, or whether it's in places like Thailand, where there's a total ban on logging, and still it's leaking out left, right, and center. The second part of the question, second only, it's often misquoted. What I think the original quote was, that second in, it was actually third in profitability to the illegal drugs trade and the illegal arms trade. The total scale of the trade is not that huge, but the profitability is pretty massive. If you think that a guy goes out in Africa with an AK-47 and kills a rhino, and he may get $50 for the rhino horn, which to him is quite a large amount of money. But that rhino horn could then retail in Asia for sort of $7,000 or $8,000 or something like that. So the markups can be incredibly high, and that's what that was referring to. And that is really one of the problems, and really one of the reasons why with the ACAP program, the Asian Conservation Awareness Program, what we were trying to do there was look at the demand, because I think it's the same with the drugs, and we've just had President Clinton going on about the whole drugs trade. If the demand's there, it doesn't matter how many poppy fields you burn, somebody else will be growing them somewhere if there's still the demand there. And unless you address the demand, you're not going to make any headway.
That's true, and I'm going to be discussing ACAP with you a little bit later. You were mentioning Siberia, and I want to get into the issue of the Siberian tigers. Can you talk about the Siberian Tiger and Community Protection Program that the Global Survival Network has set up? Can you tell the audience what that is?
Well, this is one of the happy stories, I guess, of conservation, and God knows there's few enough of those around, but Several years ago, Steve Gulster, the executive director of Global Survivor Network, put together with the Russian, local Russian government out in Vladivostok, a program to set up a series of 5 anti-poaching teams to protect the Siberian tiger. Following the breakdown of the Soviet Union, all the money for wildlife protection was pretty much gone, and the mafia was involved in all sorts of illegal trade, the illegal timber trade we've talked about, poaching of tigers, anything they could make money out of. And it really was a free-for-all. They called it the Wild East, the Wild Wild East out there, and certainly a good description. So the Siberian tiger was really down at one point, believed to be down to maybe as few as 150 individuals. And there's still a pretty sizable area of habitat left, and the animals were just being taken out, primarily to be then shipped across to China and other Asian countries for the tiger bone trade. So the poaching was really serious, and people were really looking at the Siberian tiger in the wild in decades for survival. So Steve managed to help the Russians put together a program with anti-poaching teams, and then go out to international groups and foundations like the Barbara Delano Foundation and raise money for those teams. So the Russians were absolutely dedicated and totally brave, but I mean they didn't have fuel for their vehicles, for example, and vehicles they didn't have in a lot of cases, and we're talking about a vast area they have to patrol. So Steve went out and put it together as a program, packaged it, if you like, so that international donors could support the anti-poaching. The US government, in fact, we talked earlier, the Soviet Union, the Fish and Wildlife Service actually provided some funding as well for these anti-poaching teams. And the good news is that 5 teams, at probably a cost of about $300,000 a year, have actually turned around the situation. And in the latest surveys that have been done by scientists, they now reckon the population is probably up to about 350, and it's on the increase. And that's probably the only tiger population, wild tiger population in the world that is thought to be on the increase. So that's a very positive story, and something which we're trying to emulate in a number of different countries, because our figuring was that if you can do it in Russia with the economic circumstances there are there, then you can probably do it anywhere. If there's enough political will from the local government to enable the legal changes that need to come into place, and then if the money can be found to support the anti-poaching, which in a lot of cases in these countries it's not a lot of money, and if the international community can come up with some of that money, then we can save these animals.
In the case of the tiger, what is the big attraction that has caused it to be hunted and poached nearly to extinction all over the world?
Well, it was primarily skins that tigers were hunted for, probably up to 20 or 30 years ago. And then since then, a number of experts are saying that it's actually the bones that are now the primary product. Of course, the thing about tiger bones is it's very difficult to identify them from the bones of any other animal. So I've just come back from India, and there again, they're saying that a number of the dealers now are not bothering with the skins because they're too easy to be identified, and that means that they can be caught too easily, whereas the bones, they can pass them off as cow bones, as whatever they like. So it's the bones is certainly one of the major products from the tiger.
And what are the bones used for?
Bones are used in traditional Chinese medicine for a number of applications, but most commonly sort of arthritis and rheumatism related problems. One of the major problems, which has been somewhat reduced now, is that in China they were mass producing tiger bone products. The factories which would churn out literally thousands of tiger bone plasters and other things like that. A number of these factories held stockpiles of these products, and they were a major consumer, I think, of tiger bone. That has stopped to some extent, although some products are still coming out from China. Most of them don't contain tiger bone. They may say they do, but they don't contain tiger bone.
I've heard varying estimates, but how many tigers are actually left in the world today, and understanding that several subspecies of tiger are already extinct?
Well, you'll always get varying estimates because we don't know is the short answer. The estimates vary between sort of 4,000 and 6,500, and even that's guesswork. Basically, to give you some idea, in India, one of the ways they count tigers is by using pug marks, their paw prints. And to show how inaccurate that method was, one biologist showed a number of the researchers samples from 5 zoo tigers, and they put the estimate on the number of tigers between, I think it was like 30 and 50 tigers, so shows you how inaccurate some of the methods that are used are. And of course, like many animals, they live in very remote places, and it's very difficult to get any comprehensive ideas of numbers. But really with tigers, we're looking at around 5,000, let's say, and that's 5 subspecies. 3 subspecies are already extinct, and now there's 5 left, and the South China tiger, has to be said, is thought to be down to probably no more than a dozen, 2 dozen in the wild, and people have, I think, are pretty much writing that off now, that it's not going to be able to survive in such low numbers.
Do you think that there has been an increase in recent years in commercial marketing of animal parts and products to make them more acceptable to consumers, the way, for instance, fur and seal parts are being marketed in the West?
Well, I think the traditional medicine products like the bear bladder, the rhino horn, and the tiger bone, what happened was with the sort of economic boom in Asia, a lot more people were able to afford this. The marketing is not done in quite the same way, although a number of these patented medicines, as they're called, produced in China, come in very fancy packaging and made to look very attractive with pictures of the tiger on front, etc. But I don't think that's really the case with much of the wildlife trade. I mean, some of the things you see sold there are not really packaged at all, and I mean, I've been offered tiger skins in absolutely appalling conditions and skeletons with maggots crawling out of them, so that's not so much of a concern for this. I think we're not talking about quite a sophisticated market in terms of the way that things of fur is now being marketed. It's not quite as sophisticated as that.
And also, how do you counter the influence of an uncritical mainstream media, like the one in the United States, for instance?
The U.S. media actually has been, from all the work I've done, I've actually worked probably certainly in Africa, Asia, Europe, and the U.S. media is probably the least interested in environmental issues, which is quite bizarre, really, because I think the U.S. public is interested in environmental issues, particularly wildlife issues. They're usually quite colourful, and people are usually quite keen on them. The U.S. serious media will cover things sometimes on wildlife, but there usually has to be a political angle to it. So it's difficult. And again, one of the ways to try and get coverage is to use the video footage and things like that. And we've had some quite good pieces on various news outlets with video footage and things like that, but they're not usually prepared, journalists are not usually prepared to go and do the research themselves for these stories. They'll check out the research, but a lot of this stuff does take quite a lot of time to get into it and to sort of really infiltrate the illegal trade. It takes time and resources, and often the media is not prepared to do that on something like this.
One of your reports mentioned covert wildlife trading channels from the Primorsky territory to China, South Korea, Japan, Europe, and the United States. How do you intercept and halt this degree of corruption?
Well, you can only ever get snapshots of what's going on. And then you can try and put pressure for governments to clean up their own act, if you like, and that's the real thing. Quite a lot of these things, I think, like tiger bone, for example, there's no doubt that the trade from Primorsky Krai in Russia has greatly reduced, and this is because there's been anti-poaching teams working there, and the traders, some of whom are mafia, are basically, if you turn up the heat, they'll do something else. They're really there. They're not there because they want to destroy tigers. They're there because they want to make money. And if they think there's a risk of being caught, and perhaps, you know, you trade a couple of tiger skins and you end up getting caught for dealing cocaine, now, it's not worth it to them. So what you have to do is you have to change the economics of the whole business. Now, whether it's reducing the demand or making the trade more difficult, the chances of interception higher, the fines higher, a jail sentence or whatever, that's what you have to try and do. You have to try and squeeze people out into another business. So it's one after the other, and we found with the bird trade that as that closed down, a number of those people got into trading reptiles. And, you know, it can be quite frustrating, but that is the only way we can do it at the moment.
In what way is organized crime involved in all of this? You've mentioned the mafia a few times.
Well, the organized crime is, I think, probably involved in just about every criminal activity there is, and this is a criminal activity. So often they have the channels already to ship stuff. I mean, there's been a number of cases here in the US where it's actually worked the other way around, where wildlife has been used to smuggle drugs, for example. They had a number of snakes stuffed with cocaine came into Miami. The parrots, the same thing, with cocaine inside them. And it's just another way of making money for people. And, you know, it's sometimes I think it's a bit more of a novelty to them as well. And again, it's about the way we try and counteract that is by stepping up the heat on it. If the fish and wildlife catch, you know, drugs trafficker, then that's good for them. They get a heavier sentence in the end.
What is the link between human rights issues connected with the poaching of wildlife, for instance, and the unrestricted logging and subsequent criminal activity that goes on in these regions?
That's a complicated one. The thing I think a lot of people don't realize is the wise use movement, if you like, likes to always paint it as a humans versus animal story. And in most cases, in my experience, when you get down to it, the animals are being screwed and the local people are being screwed. Just going back to Orissa in East India, where I've just come back from, with the turtles are being killed by mechanized trawlers that are, some are foreign-owned, some are owned by people in Delhi and Bombay, and they're fishing out the fishery and fishing out at the same time catching the turtles and drowning the turtles. So not only are the turtles being destroyed, but the local fishermen's living is being destroyed. And it's got to the point where the local fishermen, who don't have mechanized boats, they go out in small boats and use small nets. The fishery's been so destroyed that they're actually now using mosquito net type fineness to catch shrimp larvae for the shrimp farms, at the same time taking out all the fish fry and killing the fish fry in the process, which means that they're actually even destroying the fishery to an even greater extent. So here the turtles' interests and the local people's interests are totally in line. Both of them need a healthy local coastal area for the fishing and for surviving. And I think that is one of the biggest myths that's always used by big business and the multinationals is say, oh, the poor people. But in a lot of cases, the people are suffering to the same degree as the animals. Their lifestyle is being destroyed. Somebody's making money, but it's not usually the local people.
Can you describe the community outreach program and the habitat protection program measures that halted the decline of the Siberian tiger?
Well, one of the community outreach processes, which is again something which has happened in different projects around the world, is to actually get the local people involved in the anti-poaching efforts. I mean, to help them understand why the efforts are going on, but also to get them involved. So one of the things that's happened in Russia is to have a local people, the Udagi people, who are in fact hunters themselves, but they don't hunt the tigers, they actually revere tigers. They've seen their natural hunting decrease dramatically because essentially outside poachers coming out and taking out not just the tigers but also the deer and their other prey species. So essentially it hasn't been a case of having to persuade the people to support the tigers. They do support the tigers, but actually get them involved in the programs to protect the tigers by joining the anti-poaching teams and things like that.
I think one of my criticisms of the United States government, and here's a good example of it, U.S. lumber companies, I understand, are already in negotiations with traders in eastern Russia, and I guess that's where they'll be headed after they've completely decimated the forests here. And the U.S. government is circulating information on so-called opportunities for traders and investors. How does this affect your efforts?
Well, I couldn't comment on that particular case, but it is obviously a sort of two-handed sword here, because they're also supporting a number of conservation programs out in the Far East. There's a fine line between let's say free enterprise and commercial exploitation to the degree of destroying nature. So you know, it's a fine line, and sometimes, obviously, the U.S., as just about every other government in the world, is involved in sort of exploitation. I think more worrying, perhaps, than some of those things are some of the activities that the World Bank is funding, which is essentially an offshoot of the U.S. government. Some of the World Bank projects around the world have been totally devastating to wildlife, whether it's chopping down forests to grow monocultures for cash crops. You know, that kind of thing, I think, is perhaps much more serious than what you're talking about. And I think we really do need to review the whole USAID and also the World Bank and their influence on not just wildlife, but again, it's the local people. You know, that I've just been reading today about the World Bank activities in India and how they're, you know, they've cut down forests which were supporting local tribal people and replaced them with big monocultures owned by large ranch owners. And that doesn't help the local people at all, and it doesn't help them develop. It lines a few big pockets, but that's a much more serious and widespread problem, I think, than some of the more minor activities that the U.S. government may be encouraging investment here there. But some of the aid schemes are certainly need to be looked into.
Well, you've had some success with the Siberian Tiger Protection Program. Have you extended that program to include other animals?
Well, we're also looking at, I mean, in the same areas, there are leopards, Amur leopard, which is thought to be down to around 40, which is severely endangered. And then also bears, Asiatic black bears and brown bears, which again have been subject to the same kind of poaching pressure. So the tiger teams don't just do tigers, they do other species. And really, you pick a species like the Siberian tiger, it's a sort of flagship species, if you like, and what you're aiming to do is not just protect that animal, but everything else underneath it. And it's usually a sign if you can keep the tigers there or other key species, whether it's elephants, rhinos, whatever is there as the top animals, everything underneath is in place as well, and that's what you're really trying to do, is protect the whole ecosystem, the whole area.
I'd like to talk about the poaching of bears. It's very upsetting to see how bears are being mercilessly poached for their gallbladders and paws.